Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to an experimental psychologist who's turned into a comparative psychologist who's turned into studying animal behavior. So animal behavior, why would we study that? Presumably to learn something about our own behavior, how to modify, what's the evolution of behavior? Well, the expert today is Matthew Anderson. He's a professor of psychology at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. And Matthew, welcome to Science Studio.
Hi, thank you, Keith. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is going to be interesting because we don't do too many programs on animal behavior, and certainly not from someone who's trained as a psychologist. So, but before we get into that, let's dig into Matthew a little bit. Matthew Johns Anderson, how did you get into the whole business of science and research?
Let's see. I did my undergraduate training at Susquehanna University, which is a very small, excellent liberal arts school in central Pennsylvania. And I started out actually as pre-veterinary. And just general interest in animals, and
but when did that start?
I was more interested in their behavior, so I switched over to psychology.
But when did that start? I mean, you just don't decide that at 18.
I've been interested in animals for as long as I can recall. Frankly, I've been to just about every zoo I can think of. it's been sort of a lifelong interest.
Do you have pets?
Oh, absolutely. We've always had lots of cats and bunny rabbits and all this funny little.
That's interesting. I like cats, but I like mine. And the trouble with cats is that they're rather prone to wander. And so one gets overrun by other people's cats. And that's an issue, but we won't get into that. Well, we might do.
We could talk about cats later.
Yeah, because you learn a lot about human behavior from people who have cats as opposed to people who don't. But anyway, so where did you do your graduate studies, and what was your graduate thesis, for example?
Okay, so I finished up my undergraduate degree, and I went to Kent State, which is a state school in Ohio. I entered the graduate program in experimental psychology there. They have a bunch of sort of sub-specializations, and my specialization was in animal learning and behavior. And so traditionally, I mean, if you think psychology, you think clinical application and therapists. A lot of people don't tend to think about the research side of the field, but there are quite a few of us who are, you know, specializing in those kind of areas.
And so how did that move then into animal behavior, or was that part straight
away? Well,
that was
part of my training. So my dissertation, for instance, was on infantile amnesia, and I used animal models, rats in particular. Most of my work has actually been done with rats until recently. But I was using infant rats and studying their memory processes and realized that, you know, infantile amnesia, of course, the phenomenon is basically that, you know, you can't remember anything from your childhood prior to the age 3 or 4, typically. And it generally implies, of course, that infantile memory isn't as strong. My dissertation showed that basically what happens with infantile memory is that you lose bits and pieces of sort of the entirety of the memory, and then so you lose the specifics of it before you lose the entirety of it. And I showed this with animals, and other folks have shown this with people as well. So it seems to be sort of a general process that's relevant to many species.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, most families nowadays, I mean, I've got a bunch of children, and I know we've got reams of documents about what they did as children, you know, in terms of photographs and videos and the like. And so they know everything about their childhood.
but
they don't have memories, therefore. They probably just remember the photographs.
They have memories of you talking about them. And that's one of the reasons that research is really really difficult to do with human subjects.
Right.
Is that most of them have been, you know, reminded of the events many times over, so you can't tell whether or not you're actually studying a legitimate memory versus some story that they've been frequently.
You know, I have many stories of my own childhood that I've got from my aunt, my sister, my family. You know, like coming home from school with a new jacket and exchanging the jacket for a tadpole in a park. You know, I don't remember a thing about this, and I must have been at least 5. But, you know, it's a great story, and I'm sort of happy to, you know, regale it from time to time. But I remember nothing. So in general, would you say that most normal people don't have very good memories of, say, years of, obviously, let's say 0 to 7?
7 might be pushing it a little bit, but certainly 0 to 3, 0 to 4, absolutely, those memories are very difficult to recall later on, if not impossible.
Are there special people out there with some genetic little trait that allows them to have good memory?
That would be speculative on my part, but there are different theories on this. William James, one of the classic first psychologists in America, had an idea that people vary in their degrees of memory capabilities. Other people have spoken similar things over the years. I'm not really sure it's a genetic issue or not, though.
How is your memory? How far back can you go?
I'm very forgetful.
You're a professor. Sorry.
Absolutely.
I forgot. Well, anyway, I the reason we're doing this program is because I'm a great aficionado of the BBC, and their science page just recently had this wonderful article with a lovely photograph of a flamingo, as usual, on one leg. And scientists have discovered why flamingos stand on one leg. And that led to you. So tell us a little bit about, to begin with anyway, your work on flamingos and why flamingos?
Sure. When I was in graduate school, I got interested in primarily been working with just rats up to that point. And I had some wonderful experiences working with rhesus macaque monkeys. And I just got interested in different types of animals other than the typical laboratory rat, which is what most psychologists were studying. And when I finished my degree and I got my job at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, a great school, my interest has shifted more to avian behavior. I'm still doing a great deal of work with the rats, and I've published a little bit on people as well, but I'm interested in looking at some species that have not received the attention by psychologists. That feels warranted. I think we can learn a lot from other animals, and the flamingo is a great example of this. The flamingos are very social animals, so anytime you're interested in a behavior that might have some kind of social influence on that behavior, it might be influenced by other individuals, essentially. And the flamingo is a great model for that. They live in flocks of thousands and thousands of birds, and they're very highly gregarious in that way. So that's one of the reasons I got interested in them. Informally, it was a trip to the zoo with my family, and at the time I had my daughter was very young, and the flamingo exhibit at the Philadelphia Zoo is a wonderful exhibit, and the birds are very close to the general public, and so we spend a lot of time. My daughter was very captivated by them because they're big and pink and really close up, so we spent a lot of time looking at these birds, and I just got to thinking about some of the behaviors we were witnessing, and when I did some literature research, I found that a lot of questions remained unanswered about this animal.
Precisely this one about their posture.
Well, this is, if you go to the zoo where they're displaying flamingos, most of the time it's sort of in the middle of the afternoon, and that tends to be a time when the flamingos sleep. You see the flamingo exhibit, there's lots of birds resting, and you're going to notice a couple things about the behavior, one of them is going to be, they're resting on one leg. The other thing we've looked at with flamingos is the direction that they curve their necks when they sleep. So when they rest, they put their heads on their backs, and they have these really long necks, so it forces them to curve their necks to either the right or the left. So when you see the birds resting, you see them resting their necks to the right or left, and you see them resting on one leg. The initial questions we were asking, I was curious about, was, why do they do this? Do they have preferences for one leg over the other? And what might we learn from this bird, essentially?
And the other question, of course, if they turn their necks to the left, are they standing on their right leg or their left leg? And so this is what you've done by observation.
Yes, my graduate students and I, Sarah Williams is one of my graduate students, and her and I and several other students from St. Joe's have clocked many, many hours of observation. We note, which bird. The good thing about doing flamingo research at the zoo as opposed to in the wild is that the birds are individually numbered. They have little leg bands, and so you can tell who's who. So you can track individual behavior over time. That's a really good advantage to doing this type of research in zoos as opposed to in the wild where, there's thousands of birds and you don't know who's who.
Okay, so then what's the quantitative set of data?
Well, we showed a couple things. We showed that essentially if you watch the bird over a period of time, as far as its neck resting direction preferences here, you'll see that the birds can go either direction. They can rest their necks. Any one bird can rest either to the right or left, but over time they tend to show preferences, and typically they'll show that they prefer to rest their necks to the right. And that seems to be a preference, at the individual level, so any one bird tends to display that, but also at the flock level, which is kind of cool. But as far as leg stance goes, they go back and forth. There doesn't really seem to be any relationship there between the way that they're resting their neck and which leg they're standing on, and they don't really seem to have any preferences in which leg they stand on.
Well, that would seem reasonable to me, because when you're resting your neck, you're resting your neck, but when you're standing on one foot, all the work's being done on that one foot, so you'd want to keep on changing.
Absolutely.
Is that too simplistic?
No, I think you're dead on. And one of the things
can we
that,
publish together, or have you already published this?
No, we're out there on this already.
Okay,
this is zoo biology. It's published online presently. And some of the laterality stuff we're talking about has been published in the journal Laterality, and both of those guys are
okay.
A separate paper for the next and the separate paper for the lay. Or the
okay,
next
so that's at least a statistical analysis. So
yeah.
Now tell me about why they do it.
Well, I have a theory about it, but one of the more interesting findings, in my opinion, theoretically interesting findings that I've obtained in this area, we recently showed, and this is an online publication presently waiting to be published in print, but in the journal Laterality, we showed that those birds that, as I said, most birds prefer the rest of their necks to the right. Those birds that differ from that sort of norm and prefer the left are actually more likely to be involved in aggression, which is kind of cool. And it suggests that there's a sort of social cohesion mechanism at play here. And I think what we're seeing is sort of an underlying brain asymmetry. I think we're seeing evidence of this. The brain, of course, has contralateral control of the body. So at least I haven't done any neural imaging or anything. But my theory is that, you know, when the bird is resting its neck to the right, that's probably controlled by the left hemisphere of the animal's brain. When it's resting its neck to the left, it's controlled by the right. So those birds that are resting their neck to the left, its right hemisphere is probably under control of that behavior. The right hemisphere in many species has been shown to be linked to emotion. And so my working theory is that maybe what I'm seeing is, at least for neck resting, is that I'm getting some evidence of an underlying hemispheric dominance, really. So birds that prefer the rest of their necks to left are more right-brained almost than, you know. Now, as far as the...
Hang on a minute before you go on that. So you're talking about one side of the brain being more associated with aggression.
Yes.
Right? And so those are the birds that rest their necks to the left. Do you see evidence for aggression in flamingos?
Absolutely. Well, flamingos generally, I mean, they're not likely to hurt each other. But there have been numerous studies on aggression in this species. We study Caribbean flamingos. It's worth pointing out that there are six species of flamingos. But in flamingos, generally, what they do when they have some minor fights, essentially. They fluff their feathers up in a little piloerection, it's called, as a threat display. They will essentially sword fight with their bills, referred to in the literature as bill fighting. They will, stretch their necks out in front of them and honk, sort of goose-like honk, approach in a threatening manner other birds. They'll just run.
And this is territorial
birds.
Or just sheer fun?
You see more of this during breeding season, so there's some suggestion that might be, competition of some form. You do see a lot of this when the birds are on the nests. They make these mud nests. Because thousands of birds, they're colonial nesting birds. There's lots and lots of birds in the same place. You get that many animals in the same place, they're going to have some conflict, essentially. So you see them when they're on their nest occasionally. They're very defensive, so they'll yell and honk and have little fights.
Well, do you have evidence that those that sort of exhibit more aggression tend to be more successful in being left alone and getting space, and therefore is there a genetic feature that's going to be multiplied? They're all going to be left resters in the 500 years from now?
That's actually a very good question, I honestly don't know. There are far fewer left resters than there are right resters. So that seems to suggest that this is probably not a real beneficial kind of behavior. I'm not really sure where this is going to go over time.
Okay. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest today is Matthew Anderson from St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. And we're talking about animal behavior, in particular about flamingos. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Every day, millions of Americans who take medications also drink grapefruit juice. I do.
But they don't realize the combination can be toxic and even fatal. A new study identified 85 drugs that interact with grapefruit juice, of which 43 can cause serious problems.
That's more than we previously recognized. Many are common prescriptions, such as Lipitor to lower cholesterol, Nifiniac to lower blood pressure, Xanax for depression, oxycodone to relieve pain, and even Viagra.
What grapefruit or grapefruit juice do when combined with certain drugs is to increase the amount of the active drug in the bloodstream to potentially toxic levels.
A drug is absorbed and begins working soon after it's in the body, absorbed in the small intestine, into the bloodstream, and then the liver. During that process, enzymes begin metabolizing or breaking down the drug to remove it from the body, a natural response to rid the body of foreign substances.
About half of all drugs are metabolized by an enzyme from a superfamily of enzymes called cytochrome P450. But the process is compromised when people eat or drink grapefruits, Seville oranges, tangelos, limes, and pomelos, which contain something called furanocoumarins.
These compounds lower cytochrome P450 in the intestine, so instead of inactivating drugs, more enters the bloodstream. People can suffer liver and kidney damage, GI tract bleeding, respiratory failure, bone marrow suppression, rapid heart rate, and even death.
The effect can persist hours after drinking grapefruit juice. Visit our website and check with your doctor for drugs that should not be combined with the fruit.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Hello, welcome back. This is Keith Pannell, Science Studio, with Matthew Anderson, Professor of Psychology at St. Joseph's University, Philadelphia. And we're talking about flamingos and some of the patterns of behavior. So we just went through the neck resting business. Now talk about the foot resting business.
Well, you know, that's two dominant characteristics of flamingo resting behavior. One, they rest their necks one way or the other. The other is they typically are going to be standing on one leg. And so, you know, why do they do that? First, let me say that it is widely has been assumed over the years that there's some thermoregulatory mechanism. I mean, that's what our data suggests. This isn't a new idea. Most people have assumed that. The data has never actually been presented before, and that's kind of why our paper has, I think, received a little bit of attention. Anyway, so what we see, our findings are, first off, that more birds essentially tend to rest on one leg on colder days than on hotter days, so we have a lovely correlation. And that's sort of one big piece of evidence. That's,
now, do you do that by big extremes, or can you really do this from 30 up to 70 and get a straight line plot?
Well,
that's Fahrenheit.
There are some constraints to my study here. First off, the birds at Philadelphia Zoo, where I'm doing this research, are housed indoors in the winter, so I can't really test in extreme temperatures. But what's even more impressive, I think there's something even impressive about it. So most of our data is attained during summer months, and even with minor variations in temperature, there seems to be this behavior sensitive to very, you know, reasonably minor changes in temperature. That really suggests that they're using this in response to the temperature changes that they're encountering, even very minor ones. And people will say, oh, well, they're mainly tropical, and so why would they need this? And that's true. But they spend the vast majority of time in the water, and water is inevitably going to suck away a lot of the body heat a lot quicker than air would. And so they really have a great need for a very sensitive and effective thermoregulatory mechanism. So we show that the number of birds resting on one leg is sensitive to the temperature. We show that...
The point is then that the higher the temperature, the less one-footed behavior?
Yes, that's the idea.
So the colder the temperature, they're sort of wrapping something around their necks to keep warm.
Yeah, that's essentially the idea. Now, you can imagine resting on one leg is going to help conserve body heat. Resting on two, perhaps, would help eliminate excess body heat. On days when it's unbelievably hot, the more surface area, more legs, essentially, that you're sticking out there, the more heat can escape. The bird legs, in general, are really not that insulated, so they really are pretty good at expelling body heat really quickly.
So have you used any infrared photography to sort of show this?
No, not yet. That certainly may be one direction we go in the future. There is some evidence in other bird species. Some researchers have done similar things to that. So it wouldn't surprise me that would be the case in flamingos as well.
So they're not the only bird that does this one-foot behavior?
Absolutely not.
Give the audience some idea of other birds that we may be able to see.
Well, I think very clearly any aquatic bird in particular, things like herons and storks and ducks perhaps even, you might see this. So any bird that's spending a great deal of time in the water, I wouldn't be surprised that this would be the case.
And would you expect then the same left-right business of resting the neck?
Now, what we show is that the flamingos don't have a preference in leg stance, so they go back and forth. Now, that is probably an adaptation to... Because essentially, if you stood on one leg all the time, you'd be more likely to lose a lot of body heat from that one leg. They may perhaps even have... I don't know if they're going to have tissue damage. I don't know if it gets quite that cold where they're at, but perhaps. So switching back and forth is essentially, at least our theory is that it's a mechanism to help, additionally help conserve even more body heat than just standing on one leg.
So just one final question on this. You'd expect the more flamingos in statistically to be standing on one leg at night than they are during the day.
I would suspect that that's true, yes.
Oh, but you haven't done that experiment.
No, I haven't done that particular analysis. That's a good question.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some ways to pull that study off, too. That's a good question.
Let's go to the other feature about flamingos, then we'll move to some of your other animals.
Sure.
But the food. One knows that flamingos are supposed to be pink because they eat lots of shrimp. At least that's common wisdom. Is that true?
It is true. Not necessarily shrimp in particular. Shrimp, full-grown shrimp would probably be a little big. Flamingos are filter feeders. They have a lovely mechanism. Their bill has, it's kind of like, if you look at their bills, they're kind of ridged. It looks almost like the hairs of a comb. And what they do is they suck water through the front of their bill and sort of expel it out the sides, and the bill essentially catches little microorganisms, algae, bacteria, things like that, little mini crustaceans. And that's their diet, essentially. And that incidentally takes a long time. It probably takes a while to get enough food to sort of satisfy the birds. So that probably adds to the fact that they're spending lots of time in the water. Well, anyway, what they're taking from this food is a pigment, amongst other things, that's basic nutrition. This pigment then essentially is metabolized and makes its way to their feathers. And
well, hang on. Is that a specific pigment that only
it's,
flamingos?
It's a carotenoid. Yes. It's a type of carotenoid. There's lots of carotenoids out there, and it's a very common pigmenting, essentially, mechanism for birds.
Why aren't there more pink birds then?
There are some. The spoonbill. Well, there's enough of them. But the carotenoids are not necessarily always pink. Sometimes they produce yellows, sometimes different shades of reds.
Well, so that brings up that really entertaining concept of changing their diet. And so you get yellow flamingos, blue flamingos. Is this a reasonable possibility?
Well, that's a good question. Blue, let me comment on that one first. The blue, most bird species, blue is not obtained through a pigment. If you see a blue bird, it is actually a structural coloration. There's something about the actual structure, physical structure of their feathers
right.
that reflects only certain wavelengths.
Yeah, it's physics, in fact, so it's not biology at all.
Yeah, that's accurate, yeah. Now, there are lots of different pigments that come into play. You have melanins and the carotenoids that we talked about, but yeah, there are other mechanisms birds use as well. Now, if you change the flamingo's diet, most likely what you'd see is a paler flamingo. And even within as an exhibit, you'll see animals if they're not eating right or if they're different ages even, sometimes they're different colors. Now, certainly you have different molts. And
okay.
The juvenile birds are brownish or
So flamingos can gray with age also then?
Well, if their diet is lacking something, they will turn white. And when you remove a flamingo feather, it actually, and if it's taken away essentially from the source of the carotenoids there, it will actually fade. And that's one of the reasons flamingos really, as far as poaching for their feathers, that's never really been that big of a deal for flamingos.
Ah, interesting.
Because their feathers fade really quickly.
So not like the macaws and all these other animals that people like for headdresses
and carotenoids,
jewelry.
For some reason, they just don't.
Photochemistry, don't my man, sense. Photochemistry. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about some of your work on people. What are some of your interesting researches that?
To be honest, I haven't done a whole lot of work on people. I've published a couple papers on them. As I said, a comparative psychologist, I'm interested in all sorts of different species, people, of course, being one of them. I have done some work on context-dependent memory, and the idea that if you learn something in one setting and you're tested in a different one, that you won't do as well as if you were tested in the original context.
Okay, so give us a concrete example of that.
Concrete example. This is Smith ran a series of studies in the 80s. Essentially showed that if I take students in one classroom, teach students in a classroom and then test them in a completely different type of classroom, they're not going to do as well as if they were tested in the original one.
Are you serious?
My favorite example, the best example, is an example from Badley, a researcher named Badley. They trained divers, professional divers. They taught them a list of words either on the shore, next to the ocean, or under the water. And then they tested them for subsequent recall of this material, either in the same setting or in the altered setting. But they tested them either on the shore or in the water, it's either the same context or different context. And you see dramatically pretty significant decrement if you're tested elsewhere. And the idea is that essentially, as we're learning something, we are encoding all the various context cues with that original training information. so that if we have these things, tests, you know, they work as little reminders to help us pull out the remainder of the memory. At least that's sort of it.
So, I mean, is that related to the concept that you learn more by doing something than reading how to do it? I mean, I'm
sure that's part of it, yeah. That's definitely interrelated.
That I can understand.
I did some work with candy, and I had some evidence that essentially memory was more accurate. So I gave subjects hard candies of different flavors, and essentially if you altered the candy flavor test, you actually showed more inaccuracies, essentially.
Well, come on, let's, it sounds so bizarre, really. You talk about statistics here. Give us some numbers. Is it like going from 49% doing this and 51 to 46 and 54?
Yeah, it's not the end of the world if you have a contact shift, certainly
right.
not. No, but if you want optimal performance, you should try to maintain as many consistencies as you possibly can.
So give me some clues. I teach chemistry. How do I make my students better at an understanding and remembering some of the important features of chemistry?
There's a lot of great examples. I mean, it's even been shown, for instance, that if you eat something right before you're trained on something, you learn some bit of information, you better eat something right before you're tested. There's some evidence that suggests, because these internal cues work the same way as external cues.
Uh-huh.
There's some evidence that suggests that time of day matters, because your internal body clock would be at a
So if you teach
point.
A class at 9 to 10, the exam should be in the same room between 9 and 10.
Ideally, yeah.
If I give them all a candy, a little Snickers bar or some other appropriate at the beginning of the class and then give them one before the exam, that should also help? Won't send them to sleep?
That would be the idea.
It would it?
This is a popular idea. This research has been around for a long, long time.
And, yeah, but we don't seem to make much use of it. I mean, no one's told me this before.
As I said, it's not 100% loss. So it's not the most dramatic thing in the world if you don't have these things. But if you want to enhance your performance, it's not a bad idea to study where the exam's going to be, administered, or it's not a bad idea to at least put yourself in the mindset.
So is that why home teams usually win more games at home than they do away from home?
Perhaps. Very good question.
You should go down and get money from the Eagles and the Philadelphia Flyers and all these fellas.
I'm sure there's some other factors in play there, but that's a good point.
Okay, well, look, we could carry on and on with this. I love talking to psychologists because everybody thinks they know a little bit about psychology because it's about us, but in fact, we know so little about ourselves. Anyway, Matthew Anderson, St. Joseph's University, Philadelphia, thank you so much for being here and entertaining us and giving us information about your research.
Well,
thank you
very much for having me.
It's a great pleasure. And we thank Norma Martinez for putting this program together and smiling socially through the window. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The Medical Center of the Americas Foundation is developing the region's first biomedical research park. It comprises 13 acres in the MCA campus near Reynolds Street and Gateway East. Plans for the park were well received at a recent community meeting. Groundbreaking on the park's first building is expected in 2014. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.